A look back on the 2019 legislative session, black mothers face greater challenges giving birth and making public spaces in Miami safer. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Who won and who lost in this year's legislative session? We're taking a look back at the bills that passed, including a ban on sanctuary cities, the arming of teachers in schools, and changes to healthcare in Florida. Also, black mothers have higher rates of maternal deaths than their white counterparts. Racism may be playing a role within hospitals and treatment. We'll discuss a proposal to create a statewide task force to address the issue. And you can name a couple of public spaces in Miami-Dade that are dangerous to pedestrians and cyclists, I'm sure. The Public Miami Space Challenge is looking for ideas to make those spaces safer. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. The 2019 legislative session ended this weekend without much of the controversy that we've been accustomed to the last few years. For the most part, lawmakers agreed on a budget rather quickly. You can't have a session without some controversial bills passing, though, and of course there are those that didn't get a second look. Earlier today, we spoke with Elizabeth Coe, reporter for the Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times, covering the Capitol. She joined us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee, and we started by looking at the final budget all sides came to agree on.
One of the highlights in the budget that Republicans are saying is a win is money for Hurricane Michael recovery. Because FEMA reimbursements have been slow to come to the panhandle, Governor DeSantis and Republican leaders in the legislature have said that the state needs to step up and provide more money to places like Bay County or Panama City that have been hit particularly hard and continue to struggle significantly after the storm. Another one of the things that they've touted in this year's budget is money for the environment. Governor DeSantis, after he took office, had asked for $625 million for things like water projects and Everglades restoration, and he actually got more than that this year. They're saying $682 million, so $50 million of that is actually from last year's funds.
And he got all of that for his environmental projects, but he made a lot of promises about the environment. Did he get everything that he wanted?
He didn't. Money for land acquisition in this budget in the same ways that there have been in past years. I think it will also remain to be seen how that money ends up being used, because we're talking about money here, but there are also certain policy changes that didn't happen in this year's budget that may need to be forthcoming.
So the legislature passed the very controversial sanctuary cities bill, even though there are no actual sanctuary cities in Florida. Few communities are really targeted by this. What does the new law actually do?
The new law requires local law enforcement and state agencies to comply with what's known as an immigration detainer, which is a request from another law enforcement agency, basically in this case something like ICE, that would detain a person based on probable cause that that person is in the country illegally or is undocumented.
And what are the consequences? I mean, if a city or law enforcement agency deviates from the law, what could happen?
That was something that was a big topic of conversation in the legislature in the last couple of weeks. Both chambers went back and forth in kind of a ping pong match to determine how punitive the bill would become. This bill that passed is a lot less punitive, but there are still things that the federal government could do and that President Trump has threatened to do to kind of so-called, as you noted, sanctuary cities in terms of restricting federal funding or things like that.
All right, so Tallahassee wrestled back a little bit of control from local governments. They passed a bill that tackles how local governments deal with affordable housing, also a bill that basically takes away a city's right to ban products. I mean, some of the cities here in South Florida banned plastic straws and plastic bags and things of the like. Let's look at the affordable housing issue first. There's House Bill 7103, and that could have an impact on South Florida communities in how they're trying to deal with the affordable housing issue. How does that bill do that?
So what cities can do right now is tell new developers or people building new developments that they have to set aside a certain number of units for affordable housing. This bill doesn't ban that outright as a version of this proposal would have, but what it does do is say if you are a municipality that requires developers to set aside some of those units, you have to make the developer whole for the cost of doing so, not necessarily in terms of cash, but in terms of waiving fees or giving them incentives, etc.
Yeah, again, as I mentioned, some cities down here in South Florida have already banned plastic straws, plastic bags, Key West banning certain types of sunblock. Now they can't, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of a bigger push from the legislature to preempt local governments from setting their own individual laws. And lawmakers up here have said it's important to have laws that are consistent across the state that don't change from municipality to municipality or county to county to make sure that people across the state are obeying the same rules. Obviously, municipalities have a different perspective on that particular argument because they say, we know our local areas best. We should be the ones setting those regulations.
What happens to the bans that are already in place?
That's something that still needs to be determined. Obviously, there is an ongoing question about what happens because there are the patchwork of preemption or laws that would fall under preemption across the state.
Another controversial one, this a change to the Guardian program, that, of course, the program created after the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting, now allowing any teacher to be armed if the school district wants to participate in that. How many districts actually said they want to participate?
There's a couple of them, but what we're really going to see, particularly in South Florida, is a resistance, obviously, to this particular move. The past version said that non-teacher classroom staff could be armed. This bill obviously expands it to those, including teachers. But in Miami-Dade, for example, the school superintendent has already said he doesn't intend to pick that up or require teachers opt into that policy.
Have we heard from any teacher groups, teachers who approved of this?
Most of the reaction from teachers groups has been significantly opposed. We've seen the teachers unions, for example, say that this is something that they do not want. They came up to Tallahassee to argue against the bill, testify against the bill. We saw a legislature taking recommendations from the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Commission that had been created in the last year to study the tragedy. Basically say, you know, the commission recommended this, we're going to take it up.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Coe. She covers the Florida legislature for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. We're reflecting on some of the major bills that passed this legislative session. The session wrapped up over the weekend, by the way. Coe is joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Another big one, Elizabeth, is the one of the bills that we've been following, Amendment 4. Voters back in the fall restored voting rights to convicted felons. But now the legislature is putting some hurdles in front of these folks. Explain how the process now works for felons that want to vote, let's say, for example, in the 2020 election.
So for felons who want to vote in the 2020 election, it says, in keeping with the wording of that constitutional amendment, they have to satisfy all terms of their sentence. What the legislature did this year in passing this law was say that fulfilling all terms of their sentence means paying off all fines, fees, and restitution before they can register to vote.
Do we have any idea, any sense of how many people will be able to vote?
That's an ongoing question because it's actually very difficult to track if someone has paid off all these fines, fees, and restitution, because there is no statewide registry that keeps track of all of this. It's kept by a number of different institutions, clerks of courts, I mean, the judicial system, I mean, corrections. This was something that became a topic of a lot of debate. What the law, presuming it's signed, as we expect it to be, what that does is say there are a couple of options for felons, right? They can petition a judge to waive some of those fees and fines. The judge could convert them to community service hours. If, say, restitution payment to a victim is in question, the victim has to approve allowing the judge to do either of those things. But it's very much something that is going to pose a significant roadblock to some felons because we don't know how much some of them might owe because it is in a number of different kind of silos across the criminal justice system.
Let's take a look at health care. Legislature passed a bill that assures that Floridians with pre-existing conditions will remain covered if the Affordable Care Act is dismantled, but critics say it does nothing to control costs. Could you elaborate on that?
So the legislature passed a bill that basically says if the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare is repealed or struck down, what the state will continue to do is continue to require insurers to provide at least one plan that would cover people with pre-existing conditions. What critics have said about that particular plan is that there's nothing in the bill that says insurers can't charge more for that plan that would cover people with pre-existing conditions. And there are also additional things that the Affordable Care Act required, right? You can't charge someone more based off their sex or gender. You can't charge more for people attached to people with pre-existing conditions, for example, that they say there aren't protections for in this bill.
And another key healthcare issue that passed too centered around the needle exchange program. And that was a project that got started here in Miami-Dade County.
So that's a project that has been in Miami for the last year and a half, at least. It was a pilot project that the legislature approved that would allow injection drug users to exchange needles for free, taking dirty needles that could potentially transmit bloodborne diseases among users like HIV or hepatitis C, and instead use clean needles instead that would prevent the spread of those infections. And that project was so successful that lawmakers voted this year to allow that statewide, though county commissions have to approve individual programs in their areas.
It seemed like this session kind of went smoothly for the most part, but did anything surprise you?
I think that's always a bit of a loaded question with every session. One of the things that people have noted this year is that there was a lot that got done. There were a number of major conservative priorities that passed this legislature that had struggled to be passed, even though Republicans have held control of both the House and Senate for decades now. And one of the things that people have said is behind that is because the governor and the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate worked very well together. But we saw quite a bit of transactional politics this year, right? The Speaker of the House got the biggest priority that he wanted, which was repealing a system that the state has for approving where hospitals and other healthcare facilities can be built. The President of the Senate got a plan that he really wanted to build a toll road through northern Florida. The governor got a number of things that he wanted, including the sanctuary cities ban we were discussing earlier. So we definitely saw quite a bit get done. And obviously, that's a little more typical for non-election year sessions like this one was.
And Republicans seem more emboldened because, as you said, they've had control of both chambers and the governor's mansion. Now, they also have the court.
Right after Governor DeSantis took office, he appointed 3 new Supreme Court justices to replace retiring liberal ones. And so we see a balance on the state's high court that is more conservative than it has been in a very long time. We saw that play out in the legislature a little bit this year. We saw bills like requiring parental consent for abortion that made some headway this year that will continue to make headway because that is something that has been constitutionally litigated before. And some Republicans, though not necessarily all, do see an opening because there is a more friendly judicial atmosphere.
Do you see any of the bills being challenged in the court? Which ones do you see that people are going to be fighting?
There are going to be a number. I mean, this issue that we saw play out in the education sphere with vouchers, that's something that may come up before the court. We obviously are seeing this specific issue with Amendment 4. I would be surprised if someone doesn't say that this is a violation of what voters had initially intended when they voted for that item on the 2018 ballot. The court will continue to be, has always been and will continue to be, a significant player in how laws are shaped in the state. And because it now has Governor DeSantis' stamp on it pretty firmly.
I'm curious as to how Governor DeSantis differed from Governor Rick Scott in his first session, and how he got his priorities through.
Both of those politicians approached their relationship with the legislature very differently. And when Governor DeSantis first addressed lawmakers on the day of his inauguration, one of the first things he said was, "I used to be a legislator too," because he's a former member of Congress. And he said, "I understand how the legislature works. I respect the role that the legislature has to play in how laws are made and how policy is crafted." And he promised on that day to work with the legislature and kind of let them take the lead on that. And we very much saw that, I think, this year. It was something that all three of the top leaders in state government highlighted this weekend when the legislature decided to finally break and signee die, as they say up here. There are a number of people who have said Rick Scott, by virtue of his past experience as a healthcare executive, very much brought a more leadership-focused role to his governorship. So I think in a lot of ways, Rick Scott made a number of demands of the legislature, and that played out the way that it did. But Governor DeSantis came in and very much wanted a more collaborative atmosphere.
That was the Miami Herald's Elizabeth Coe joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. You can hear today's episode of The Sunshine Economy, which also tackled legislative issues, and find more coverage on this past session at our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, black mothers face greater risk of death when giving birth than white women. We'll try and figure out how to change that. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. More than 700 women die each year in the U.S. while pregnant or shortly after giving birth. An alarming number of those women are black. In Florida, black women are two times as likely to die compared to white women during childbirth. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Florida lawmakers were pushing for a maternal mortality prevention task force that would have investigated maternal deaths in the state and then come up with the best practices to prevent those deaths. Unfortunately, that plan did not go through in this session, but we'll talk about that as well. Jamara Amani is the executive director of the Southern Birth Justice Network, a founding member of the Black Mamas Matter Alliance, and a community midwife and a doula based here in Miami. And by the way, she was in Tallahassee advocating for that task force not too long ago. She joins me now in studio to talk about the scope of this problem that black mothers are facing right now. Jamara Amani, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lewis, for having me.
I appreciate it. I did also want to mention, too, that we posted up on Facebook a question. If you're a black mother and you've given birth, you've had a child, what was your experience like? We'd like to hear from you. So please find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial and share that with us. Jamara, what is it? Is it education? Is it money? Or is it simply race? Why? Why the disparity?
Well, the issue of black maternal mortality is very complex. It's not just one answer. All of those things are at play, for sure. Racism is a big factor. The amount of racism that experiences of racism that someone experiences over their lifetime will impact their health outcomes, and that has been shown repeatedly in various studies. And so we are looking at a problem of race. We are looking at the racism that people encounter in the healthcare system, as well as in their daily lives. We're also looking at education. Although we know that educated, very well-educated black women with high incomes and access to healthcare still have higher mortality rates than white women who are high school dropouts. So there's something else at play here that goes beyond education, income, and access, although those issues do matter and they do make a difference.
You've spent so many years now helping mothers, and I want to know, what are the typical concerns that you hear from mothers as they're preparing for childbirth?
Well, the number one thing is not being heard by providers, not being listened to, not having their rights respected.
So is that basically going to the doctor, the hospital, and asking for anything and not getting...
Being dismissed, yes. And it's happened to even the top celebrities that we know, like Serena Williams, who recounted her experience of giving birth and having to literally grab a nurse and say, "Help me. You know, there's something wrong and I need a medication," and having been dismissed several times before that. And so it's happening to black women everywhere. And the implicit bias is inherent in our healthcare system, unfortunately. So we have to start from scratch and go back and train providers and medical students that are just coming out, you know, on how to care for our communities. And the role of midwives and doulas really matter a lot, because midwives and doulas provide protective factors for black women, for all women, you know, for all people giving birth. But in particular for black women, there's a long tradition of midwifery care in our communities. And black midwives had been systematically pushed out of the system. And so bringing midwives back is a way to protect mothers. It's a way to make sure that their voices are heard. And that they get one-to-one humanistic, holistic care.
Throughout the entire process, from when a woman finds out she's pregnant to childbirth, are black women, along that process, I want to know what black women are not getting that white women are.
Well, it starts before that first pregnancy test, right? Because we're talking about the life course perspective, which is a theory that was advanced by Dr. Michael Liu of the CDC. Which basically states that, you know, the amount of racism that someone experiences through their lifetime will impact their health outcomes. So it starts before that first pregnancy test. It relates to the level of care that people are receiving before they get pregnant or in between pregnancies. But yes, definitely the care during the pregnancy matters too. We need quality care. We need access to care for everyone, regardless of race, income, immigrant status. We need providers that listen. We need culturally competent care. We need care that respects people's rights and their decision-making power over their own bodies. Because oftentimes people go into a hospital or a clinical care setting and feel like a number, or feel like their rights are being violated, or feel like things are being done to them and that they are not partners in their own healthcare decision making.
You said culturally competent care, right?
Yes.
Well, can you give me an idea of what that is?
Culturally competent care means providers that that people can relate to. Like if you go into a provider and, you know, talk to them about your family dynamic or your diet or your beliefs about your pregnancy or your desire to treat things holistically and use herbs or things that grow in your garden, or to, you know, move around during your pregnancy and squat like your grandma did to give birth. All of those things really matter. They matter deeply for most women who are giving birth. And being able to birth on your own terms, I know for me it was really important to have providers that looked like me, that I could relate to, that I felt safe with. It was important to me to birth in my own home. Because I knew it was a safe environment, and I knew I could wear my own clothes, eat my own food, move around like I wanted to, play my own music. And those things might sound trivial, but they matter deeply for outcomes. How people feel about their care matters deeply for how they do.
Now, my understanding is right. The first couple of children you had were in a hospital?
Yes.
And then you went and you decided to have them at home.
Exactly. And that was a big shift for me. My hospital, I can talk about one of my hospital births. I definitely needed more care and to be listened to more than I was. I felt that my basic rights were violated. My nurse told me that if I didn't stay in the bed, I could kill my baby, which is something you should never, ever say to someone in labor.
What did you say back?
I just nodded my head and smiled. I waited until she left the room. I asked my doula. Thankfully, I had a doula. I asked my doula to guard the door, and I got up from the bed and hid in the bathroom and managed my own labor from the bathroom because I knew I needed to move my body. I knew I needed to not just be flat on my back giving birth, and that was what I did. And an hour later, I gave birth to my daughter. But had I been stuck in that bed, I don't know what the outcome would have been. And there were way too many interventions. There was a lot of things done to me. My baby was removed from me when I asked for skin to skin right after birth. That was something that, you know, I wanted so that I could start breastfeeding right away. And there was just a lot that I felt like I was saying that mattered to me that people were just telling me, oh, that's not possible. Oh, we don't do that here. And just being very dismissed.
And all of this stuff can't be discussed ahead of time, or they never even gave you the option to talk about, well, how do you want to be comfortable, or
what happens ahead of time and what happens in the labor room are completely different things. When you walk into a hospital and, you know, and I'm not demonizing hospitals. We need them. We certainly need them for emergent care. We certainly need them for surgical births. You know, some women require C-sections and they're life-saving. They can be. But we have a really high C-section rate in our country. It's higher than the World Health Organization recommends. And the U.S. Outcomes for maternal health are abysmal across the board. And not just for Black women, but Black women are the most impacted by far, 3 to 4 times likely on the national average to die related to childbirth than white women. And hospitals play a big part of that because most people are giving birth in hospitals.
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned it a couple of times, and I think we need to come back to this idea of a doula. Mm-hmm. And remind us again, because you are one, and remind us again what a doula does, but you specifically, how you approach being a doula.
Sure. Well, I'm actually not a doula.
Oh, you're not?
Okay. I'm a midwife.
Oh, you're a midwife. Okay, thank you.
But I can talk about doula care because my organization provides training for doulas. Doulas are professional labor support. They are the people that meet with you ahead of time, like you just mentioned. Can't this be worked out ahead of time? Well, that's what a doula does. They sit with you and they discuss your birth plan with you. What are the things that you want to have? What's important to you? What do you value? What matters to you about your health care? And then they are in a position to help you communicate those things with your physician or midwife, you know, your OB provider. And they are also there when you give birth. And they are on call. So if you're giving birth at 3 o'clock in the morning, you can call your doula and say, hey, I'm in labor. And the doula will come and be your support person. They can be an advocate. They are also are the person that can breathe with you and help you get into different positions and, you know, rub your back and tell you, yes, girl, you can do this. Doulas are incredibly skilled at providing support for laboring mamas.
And you had a doula who basically had to act like a guard.
Yeah, my doula was definitely the guard between and the, you know, kind of buffer between me and the hospital staff. And that's a role that doulas can play. And it helps the healthcare providers. I mean, it makes less work for the nurses to have a doula in the room. And it certainly helps the families that are giving birth to have that advocate and that support person. So doulas are a huge part of the solution for maternal mortality because having a doula actually improves outcomes. And that's been shown in studies as well.
I'm talking with Jamara Amani. She's the executive director of the Southern Birth Justice Network, a founding member of the Black Mamas Matter Alliance and a community midwife based here in Miami. And we're looking at why, as I mentioned earlier, why Black women have higher rates of maternal mortality than their white counterparts. Now, this legislative session, Democratic lawmakers were pushing for a new legislation that would require the State Department of Health to establish a maternal mortality prevention task force. But that bill did not reach the governor's desk. Let's talk about that bill. You were in Tallahassee talking to lawmakers about this.
Yes.
What? Well, tell us a little bit about that trip up there and who heard you.
So I had the opportunity to travel with folks from South Florida, Floridians for Reproductive Freedom and the Miami Workers Center and folks from Southern Birth Justice Network and Florida Latina Action Network to advocate for bills that are supporting reproductive justice. And that's really, you know, a term that means that we are cared for through our whole reproductive cycle. That means we have comprehensive sex education. That means that we have access to, birth control. That means we have access to abortion. That means that people have access to maternity care that is affordable, that is accessible, that is quality. And so this, you know, group of folks went up there to advocate for that. And yes, House Bill 519, the Maternal Mortality Task Force bill, was definitely a huge part of that. And I give a lot of respect to Representative Kamia Brown for introducing that, for having the courage and the voice to bring that bill into session. And it is sad that it didn't pass this time around because we sorely need it. And we actually have federal precedent. Recently, the United States Congress launched the Black Maternal Health Caucus, which now has about 60 members of Congress that are calling for maternal task forces to exist in every state and that, you know, they should be funded, that they should be solution oriented, that they should involve a range of maternity care providers, including midwives and doulas and obstetricians and nurses. And that multi-sectoral approach is how we are going to get things done. So the trip to Tallahassee was definitely needed. We need more people going with us to raise their voices that this issue matters and so that we get this bill passed next year.
What was the response when you were up there? What did you get a sense that there was any hope for this?
I felt like it was a very supportive response. I think there was a lot of support for the bill. I think that people are concerned about this issue, that lawmakers want to understand it. And it's hard to just give a one-liner with this issue because it is complex. It is multi-sectoral. It does involve, you know, everything from, you know, the quality of healthcare to the funding of healthcare to education to respect to autonomy to people's rights. You know, there's so many factors involved with it, and it really requires us to take a hard look at our healthcare system and where are the gaps that people are falling through. But I think that lawmakers really do want to do this work. I think some of the concern is it going to cost the state of Florida money? Right.
My understanding with the task force is part of it was basically to gather a lot of data.
Yes.
That would help in future recommendations on dealing with this topic.
Yeah, because we aren't collecting enough information around the numbers. We don't really have solid numbers as to how many mothers are dying giving birth. in the United States in general, and certainly not in Florida. We need to be diligently collecting the information so that we can understand what the factors are. So that's where it starts, is gathering the data and then coming up with the solutions once we analyze the data and identify the problem.
I don't know if you can give me a number, but I'm curious as to how many Black women have access to a midwife or a doula.
I don't have hard numbers on that because, again, we don't have good data. Midwives, out-of-hospital midwives that do home births and birth center deliveries are doing about 2% of the births in the state. So it's a small number. More have access to doulas. I don't know exactly how many. The good thing about midwifery care in the state of Florida and what we are pushing for doula care is that it is compensated through Medicaid. So people who have various Medicaid plans can access a midwife and can have a birth that occurs outside of the hospital, can have the type of care that midwives provide, which is very similar to OB care. However, there are more layers to it. Midwives really care for the person holistically. So we're talking about mentally, emotionally, psychologically, you know, socially. When I see my clients, I ask them, how are you doing? How's your partner doing? How's your mom doing? What did you eat today? You know, how are you feeling emotionally? How does your family feel about your pregnancy? And my appointments usually last, you know, anywhere from 30 minutes to 60 minutes, depending on the need of the person. And most women will tell you if they go to an OB, they feel very rushed in and rushed out. 5 to 15 minute appointments. And, you know, not getting all their questions answered and not really being educated about their pregnancy. Again, it's not a dig at OBs. It's just a look at our healthcare system and ways that we can improve and how midwives and doulas can help to be a part of that solution.
Are there enough programs to train midwives? I want to know what the training is or to be a doula.
So in the state of Florida, the training of doulas is not regulated, and most people can become a doula in less than a year. It's usually a weekend training or a week-long training followed with some hands-on, you know, requirements like attending births, for example, reading books, attending workshops. Becoming a doula is pretty accessible. And once a year, Southern Birth Justice Network does a doula training. We'll be doing another one in September. To become a midwife is a little bit more challenging. It's a 3-year program. It's a requirement for 3 years in Florida to become a licensed midwife. And there aren't many programs that exist. We are actually in the process of trying to open one, but there are some obstacles. It definitely requires funding. It requires the support of the state Council of Education and the Council of Midwifery. And there's some hurdles to jump through. We currently don't have an active program in South Florida in Miami that is able to train midwives. And so people go to Boca, they go to the west coast of Florida, they go to Gainesville. But we really need to have a program here in our community so that we can see those numbers change through more access to midwives.
I don't want to let you go without asking you this, because you have an event coming up at the Little Haiti Cultural Center, right?
We do, on Friday.
Okay, tell us about it.
We're having our Black Mamas, our Trailblazers Mama's Day dinner. And it's to coincide with Mother's Day weekend, but we're having it on Friday so people can still have their Mother's Day. It's from 7 to 10 p.m. at Little Haiti Cultural Center. It's an opportunity to celebrate Black moms for all of the amazing things that we do. And we're going to have food and entertainment and dancing and a really good time. We're providing childcare. And we really just want to bring Black moms to the table to say, we know that there's these barriers and obstacles, but we just want to celebrate you.
Real briefly, what's next? I mean, we'll wait till the next session, try again, but what's next? How do we change this statistic?
Well, in the meantime, I am in my community every day caring for all mamas, but in particular, Black mamas who, need my care. I think that if the more people seek out doula and midwifery care and make those demands to their legislators that these things really matter to them, that we will start to see a shift. If we have people calling their health insurance companies and saying, is my doula going to be covered under my insurance? If we have people calling up their legislators and saying, you know, I'd really like to have a midwife, but there isn't one in my neighborhood. How can we get more midwives? then we're going to start to see this demand, you know, growing. And, you know, also what we're doing through Southern Birth Justice Network is training providers. We recently had a screening and a workshop panel at FIU Medical School, because we really believe that getting to folks that are medical students, that are still open-minded, that, you know, can come out and be doctors that make a difference, we really want to work in partnership with the healthcare system. So we're providing those trainings in our communities as well. And we'll continue to do that work all the way up until the next legislative session, where we will go to Tallahassee again to make, you know, our voices heard.
Again, Jamara Amani, Executive Director of the Southern Birth Justice Network, a founding member of the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. We'll put that information, by the way, about this weekend's event up on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Jamara, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, the Miami Public Space Challenge this year is looking for safety ideas. We'll explain. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, in downtown Miami Springs, there's a park in the center of a busy roundabout, and it's challenging for pedestrians to even get to it. And that bothered people like Maria Font, a photographer and a longtime resident of Miami Springs. For years, Font would see cars flying through the circle as people on foot tried to get over into the park. Our producer, Chris Remington, by the way, also experienced this when he first moved to Miami. He found this, and, well, luckily he didn't scare him away. Font, along with her friend Jennifer Gonzalez, submitted a proposal last year to the Miami Foundation Public Space Challenge. The organization gives out $250,000 in grants for ideas that bring new life to public spaces. And they were awarded $18,000 to build crosswalks and give this space new life. And they're also, by the way, building a butterfly garden in the park as well. The 2019 Public Space Challenge is open to the public for folks to submit their ideas. Joining me now in studio to discuss is Dawn Sheriffs with the Miami Foundation. Dawn, thanks so much for being here.
No, thanks for having us.
And also joining us is Maria Font, who won that challenge, and we're going to ask her about this park. Maria, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Lewis.
Dawn, let me start with you. You decided to focus this year's Public Space Challenge specifically on issues like the one that Maria tackled, improving how we get around the county safety.
Yep. Why? Sure. So, you know, more broadly, we've looked at the Public Space Challenge as a very across the board opportunity. Folks have had tons of ideas about urban gardens and park enhancements, but we know that the one thing sort of everybody complains about in this town is how we get around, that they're stuck in traffic or they're waiting for a train. And we really saw this as an opportunity for really enhancing collaboration as well as physical connectivity. So getting people from place to place in a way that is faster or more fun is something we really thought would be important to bringing community together.
Okay. And you know, one of the interesting things, though, is this, is, you know, compared to like past competitions, this one, I think there's a lot of layers to it. And Maria is going to tell us about the challenges that she faced in that you got to go through cities. You got to go through governments. You got to go through a lot of you got to go through a lot of bureaucracy. That's tough.
Absolutely. And that was really one of the reasons we wanted to focus. So we could provide better support to champions like Maria and others to get through those hurdles rather than trying to be sort of all over the place. We actually doubled down on our investment of local partners that will help you with your permitting, with your process challenges. And we're also putting people together to help each other and really trying to sort of build a network around these problem solvers.
And I wonder, this year compared to others or over the years, what have you seen in the number of pitches? Again, this is open to anybody. Pitch an idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So last year we had over 500 ideas coming through. It's so exciting to see that many, but really you want to drill down to your absolute best and strongest ideas where little solutions can be implemented that make a big difference in people's lives.
All right, Maria, I wondered,
yes,
what was the moment you decided it was time to do something about this circle park in Miami Springs? And again, our producer had seen it as well. I have to admit, I haven't seen it, but it sounds heinous.
Well, I loved Chris's story and hearing about it today, that he himself experienced what we're going through here, where there's no safe access to this amazing green space. And it is the heart of our little city. It has a gazebo, it has 8 oak trees, it has benches, it begs to be visited. But the only way in there is by jaywalking, pretty much. So we've been, all of the residents here just see it, and we, you know, we do make the mad dash over there, but we've wanted to do this or something special for our city. And when the Public Space Challenge came out, me and my friend and neighbor, Jennifer Yerena, we decided that this would be a great idea to make this circle safe for and residents of the Springs.
So, you know, one of the things I mentioned to Dawn is that with this new challenge, what's different is, or what, it's a little bit different, is that now you've got to go through a lot of different layers. I mean, to get to the park, yes, you have to be almost like Frogger, but now you have to go through all of this government. And what was that like for you?
Yes, it is. It has been challenging and extremely interesting. We have met with multiple people, either on email, phone calls, actual meetings. We had to go before the Miami Springs City Council just to get this crosswalk idea approved, that we can even move forward with it. It is in the city, so they needed to approve it through an agenda and a resolution. So we've met with them and got that passed. And then we've had to meet with Commissioner Rebecca Sosa and the traffic department of Miami-Dade County as well have been brought into this, because that is their road. It is a county road. So you just can't come up with an idea and execute it the next day.
No,
it's taken a lot of steps.
Maria, this is a crosswalk, right? That's the idea.
Yes.
And why was the county pushing back?
Because it is a very busy roundabout. I believe past traffic studies, it's just a very busy circle in general. And there has been pushback to have the traffic flow stop.
I mean,
But
at any point, did you just feel like demoralized by this whole thing, this whole process?
You have no idea. So many times me and Jennifer were just, we were on the verge of thinking it might just be a bad idea, that this would never come to fruition. It was just so many steps, and it took so much hard work to get to where we are today, that really it's giving me new strength to believe to never give up on an idea, because I can't believe how far we've taken this and all the positive results that have happened so far. We're really, really excited.
Dawn, how often do you find recipients like this of the grants who get into these tug of wars to try to get their idea across?
You know, I think it's a learning experience for everybody, right? The government's not used to having individual citizens come forward and implement solutions. And citizens don't have the experience trying to sort of get some of these things navigated. I actually think it's a win-win, even when a project isn't fully executed, because you're really looking at how to refine those processes and how to increase civic engagement on a person-to-person level, which is what we really need in our community to sort of stay whole, no matter what issue you're looking at. And so, yeah, we definitely identified those challenges. We wanted to increase project completion rates because we think we can deliver on these. We've got these great folks with ideas that are ready to roll up their sleeves. And so that's why we are providing sort of that level of support and coaching even more than we have in previous years, because we've learned from the past six.
Maria, so what's the verdict, I guess? Is this going to happen?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. It is. There are a couple more steps just need to happen on the city's part, on our part, and the traffic department. And once those start to get implemented now in the summertime, this project should be in the works by then and then completed before the end of the year. We are extremely excited.
I'm talking with Dawn Sheriffs of the Miami Public Space Challenge and Maria Font, a 2018 Public Space Challenge winner. The challenge, again, now open for folks to submit their ideas, focus specifically on mobility. How can people get around Miami-Dade County better and safer? You can find links, by the way, on our social media at WLRN and Sundial if you've got one of those ideas. Maria, you and your friend Jennifer work this nonprofit, Bound by Beauty. Explain what it is.
Yes. Bound by Beauty is a nonprofit organization began by our founder, Mary Benton, and our motto is to connect, educate, transform, and replicate. So the aim is to bring education to neighbors on the importance of pollinators and creating pollinator habitat, which is why the part of our grant is going to go towards a butterfly garden in that gazebo, in that center, in the Circle Park. And I guess, Bound by Beauty's main aim is just to transform and bridge the gap between these butterflies and accessing them to more nectarine plants and more plants that they need to lay and reproduce. So yeah, that's what the Bound by Beauty
I wondered. I wondered if you had any trouble getting the butterfly garden, pitch accepted faster than the crosswalk.
Well, we still actually have to take the idea for and the layout for the butterfly garden to the city council again, because that has to get approved, the type of plants that we're going to use and all of those types of things. So again, everything, there's a process to everything, even a garden. So
nope,
we're working on that.
Bureaucracy, you have to deal with it. Dawn, if people are pitching ideas, what advice do you give them on how to put together that really good pitch?
You know, I think the biggest thing is keep it simple. You have seen those little things that frustrate you, and focus on that. It's street level. You can't go bigger than that. You're not, you know, sort of positioned to do it, but you are sort of champion of your own street and your own idea. And all you have to say when you put your idea into publicspacechallenge.org is, my idea to improve this place is so that people could. It is just that simple. We really want to underscore that anybody can do this. We're here.
I want to know. Tell me, yes. Please, tell me about some of the more interesting pitches that you have seen over the years. We're not calling anybody out. I just want to see what people have been pitching. I love to see what people are thinking about.
We did have a great idea that got a lot of laughs last year about having a cat park, that there was too much competition for dog parks and we needed a cat park in Miami. There were some folks in the bird community that had some challenges with that particular idea.
Okay.
We've got some really exciting ones this year, though. We've got pedicabs in Little Haiti, so people could sort of have that tourist experience.
I heard about I'm trying to picture this, a pop-up train station?
Oh, yeah.
What is this?
So this was an activation to sort of give people an idea of what could be if you had this extra train station stop downtown. And so they made it a train station for a day. The train didn't actually go, but it was to sort of show the community what it could look like and feel like to have a center there.
Hmm. Interesting. Maria, if you gave anybody, anybody who's thinking about pitching any advice, what would you tell them?
Do not give up, for sure. You might get some roadblocks, and some people might not believe that your project has any validation, but definitely see it through, work really hard, and do not give up. So,
all right. I think we were having some issues with her connection. Oh. So you're there? Go ahead, Maria. Yeah. Sorry
yes.
about that.
No, just definitely do not give up. Do not give up. Work really hard and try every angle. And that's all I can say, because so many times we were on the verge of thinking this might not happen. And we worked so hard and spoke to so many people and learned so much along the way. And here we are. Really proud of what we've accomplished so far.
And you know what, Maria, how long is it going to take, do you think, before we finally see that crosswalk, before people can finally safely make it across into that park?
I think a couple of months, just a couple of months. I think before the end of the year, this colorful little crosswalk will be in Miami Springs.
All right. Dawn, what's the deadline? And just, again, how people should pitch their idea?
Sure. So go to publicspacechallenge.org. And you can submit your idea by May 16th and let us know how you want to reimagine mobility.
And by the way, this is just for Miami-Dade County.
That's
ideas
correct.
For Miami-Dade County.
Correct.
And again, the theme, or at least the idea for now, is we're looking at that mobility and safety.
Yeah, streets are public spaces too. How do we use them? What is that experience like?
Do you have one just off the top of your head?
Yeah.
What's something you want to change?
Oh, well, so I really like, there's in Mexico, there's been a few examples of places where they put plants all around the pilings that the metro rail sits on. And so it's this beautiful green space and greenscape instead of concrete.
All right. See, that was a great idea. And I'm kind of like, you know, I'm just being a little silly because I'm just thinking I'm looking for, you know, the way to get from Kendall to downtown faster. I'm looking for jetpacks. I'm looking for jetpacks, the fastest way I can think of. But you know what? I was also thinking one of the other ones, too, is a really lovely one that we talked about recently on the show, is the Domino's art under the metro rail. I mean, it's art, but it's, you know, just another way to try to improve our public spaces. Dawn, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Dawn Sheriff of the Miami Public Space Challenge. We'll have information on our social media, by the way, at WLRN Sundial. If you've got a great idea that you want to pitch, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Maria Font, again, a 2018 Public Space Challenge winner. Congratulations on yours, and hopefully that crosswalk gets put in really soon.
Thank you so much, Lewis. I really appreciate it.
And that is our program for today, this Monday, May 6th. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.